I'm Natalie Minnis. I run a podcast called Imagining Freedom, which I started during the lockdown, in fact, just as lockdown started, because I was the only person I knew that didn't approve of the lockdown. And it didn't mean that I don't think coronavirus exists or anything. I thought, yep, there's something going on, people are getting sick, but this is not the way to deal with it. So I just felt I had to try and connect with other people who might feel the same way as me. And I set up a podcast and really enjoyed it. It was just a good outlet for me as well. And eventually...
Did you have any background in journalism?
Yes. I used to be a journalist on trade magazines. In fact, I started off on sort of teenage and women's magazines a long, long, long time ago. And then I moved to trade magazines, and eventually the company decided that I was being paid too much and basically booted me out, which in the long term was the best thing that ever happened to me. So, and since then I've just been working for myself. So I actually, I'm training for various sort of jobs at the moment, but so the podcast is just something that I do because I just feel compelled to do it. I've had quite a difficult time over the past few months because last year my mum died, so I've been cleaning out her house. Because of that, the podcast has had to take a bit of a back seat, and I haven't done much at all over the last 4 months, but I'm really hoping to get back to it soon.
Look, Natalie, I have to ask you, what was it that prompted you to do that about the lockdowns? Most people understood and understand that certainly, even if they don't like it now, back in March last year in 2020, that it seemed to be the sensible thing to do. Everyone's pointing to the Chinese, the New Zealanders, etc., saying that they've been very successful in stopping the spread of COVID-19 through lockdown. So what was it that prompted you to question that whole idea?
I just felt in my heart that it was the wrong way to treat it. I thought, this is not going to do anyone any good. Sadly, people are dying with or without lockdown. And I actually read a fantastic article by a man called David L. Katz, Professor David L. Katz, in the New York Times back in March. And he suggested that we should be focusing all our attentions on the people who are getting sick and who are vulnerable. I thought that's the way to go. I have been increasingly questioning governments for about 20 years. But so that maybe is the reason that I felt the way I did. I felt so strongly about this. And in fact, one of my best friends got COVID-19. And it was like a bad flu. I was with her the night before she got it. It was my birthday and we were out celebrating. This was in February. So I knew that there was something going around that made people ill. I didn't get ill at all. But I just thought locking people up against their will is wrong. And I still think, even if it was the plague, to be honest, I think that's wrong. I think it should be, we should have personal freedom to make that choice. And if the risk is serious enough, I think people would go along with it. So I just felt very strongly that it was the wrong thing to do.
I mean, you can see the principle, can't you? The idea is if people are actually going around coughing and spreading an illness which is potentially deadly, that they can't be allowed to do that. I mean, we've even seen incidents, at least alleged incidents, the police say that people have been deliberately coughing at them when they try and turn up and sort of shut down demonstrations against the lockdown, that sort of thing.
Well, that's a very different thing. If someone's deliberately coughing at someone in an atmosphere where there's a pandemic going around or just an illness going around, that's wrong. That's an act of violence. So that's a different thing. But you can't criminalise the healthy for potentially spreading an illness. I was extremely ill for years when I was a tiny child, in the age of 18 months to 4 years old. It started with me getting measles. And actually, after that, I got a vaccine, and I think possibly the vaccine was more responsible for the measles for me, my health deteriorating. And that was before the measles vaccine even existed, because I was born in 1962. At no time in my life have I ever thought that people should have been locked up just to prevent children potentially getting the measles. It's outrageous to me. So you know, in life, people get ill and die, unfortunately.
Well, certainly some of the statistics do bear out what you say, and that the 2017-2018 flu year was roughly 50,000 extra people died with the flu. And this, is, of course, is another thing. People are apparently dying of COVID-19, where actually what's happening is they have comorbidities, as they call it, or underlying health conditions, and they're dying with COVID-19 rather than of COVID-19 yeah. in the statistics. Now, the statistics have played a very, very important role in this, in that we're getting these kind of nightly statistics on the BBC and ITV. The television has also played a very important role. Do you want to say something about the stats, and yeah. have you got any questions about the way they've been presented on television?
Totally. To be honest, I don't watch TV. I stopped watching it in 2012, not because I had anything against it, just due to circumstances, and I just didn't miss it. I stopped watching it and forgot all about it. But now, if I catch a news broadcast on the radio, it just seems like absolute propaganda, like the kind of thing that the Russians were listening to in the 1980s, you know. And when I look at BBC Online to keep up with the news, and it's very interesting the way that they present their stories, because they'll present them with a scary headline. And I think people just freak out about that. And then they'll just look at the headlines or the scary pictures. And that is what they take in on an emotional level. But if you scroll down those features, sometimes you get a completely different picture. So that happened about 10 days ago. They had an article and a big scary headline saying that there was the highest number of deaths in 2020 since World War II. But when you looked into that, they were saying they were basing it on 5-year averages, and they didn't actually present any of the actual statistics of the 5-year averages. But if you scrolled down, you saw another chart, which was deaths per 100,000. And that was a totally different picture, because it said that 2020 was the highest number of deaths since 2010. And that in 2002, I think it was, there were massively more deaths per 100,000 than in 2020. But the story was about the worst number of deaths since World War II. Most people would just think, oh my God, we're back to a World War II situation. So it's the way they skew it.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, what you're looking at there is, you know, what they're doing is they are misusing the proportion of death. So, you know, you've got nearly double, well, actually not quite double, it's something like an extra third of population. So you'd expect the deaths now to be, you know, far, far greater than the 1950s or even the 1940s. So they're not actually doing it as a proportion of the population, they're doing the total of the population, which has grown massively anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you can do with statistics, you can look at them in many different ways. And the BBC seems to be picking out certain scary aspects of the statistics. But it's almost as if they want to cover themselves, so that if people say, well, look, you were just inflating the fear, you were just trying to ramp up the fear, they can say, well, actually, we've got all the stats spelled out in this article. There was another article they did last year, I think it was about August or sometime in the summer, and they had this big headline, bodies in New York being piled onto refrigerated vans. And it sounded, when you looked at the headline, you thought, well, there must be so many people dying in New York that they've got to put them in refrigerated vans. But what had actually happened was that the freezer in a care home, or I think the freezer in a mortuary that dealt with several care homes, had broken down. So they had to put the bodies in refrigerated vans while they fixed the freezer. It was nothing to do with excess deaths. But in that BBC article, further down, they had the story about there was an island off New York where bodies are buried. And again, it was presenting the picture that there's so many deaths that they're having to bury the dead on this island. But when you looked at it, there was a little video, and the BBC even said that this island has been used for years for burying people who don't have immediate relatives or whose relatives can't be found. So they're saying it, but they're saying it in such a kind of convoluted way that you, that if you're of a nervous disposition, you'll just see these scary pictures and headlines, and you probably won't read on and find the actual facts, which are much less scary.
Yeah, I mean, you said initially that, you know, it was almost like an emotional response, feeling in your guts that, you know, there's something wrong with the idea of locking down the country, like you would lock down a prison riot or something. Yeah. What do you make of the way that fear has been used? Because it's actually quite a powerful weapon, isn't it, fear? It can be used to really, I suppose, get under people's skin and hit directly their unconscious mind. So they're making decisions where they're not actually, it's almost bypassing their will.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It definitely is a psyop. That's what's going on. And you can tell that because I don't know how many people who normie type people who believe the whole thing as it's spelled out by these news organizations. I don't know how many arguments you've had with them, but it usually, to me, if I don't argue with someone, if I just present a different view in a very calm way, I get an eruption of emotion. People can't, they're not arguing in a rational way. They just get so emotional. And I think that's because this is actually affecting the heart rather than the head. People, it's playing on people's fear, just as that SAGE document, number 18, I think it was, the 18th SAGE meeting, said that they wanted the fear to be ramped up. And that's what's going on.
Yeah, so we've also seen a big influence from Bill Gates in all of this. Much of what you're saying about the statistics have been coming out of, and in fact, basically just cut and pasted into many of the national papers in the United States and in the UK from John Hopkins University, which has an entire department looking at epidemics, which is funded by Bill Gates directly. So basically it's his block on the side of the university, and we've got exactly the same going on at Imperial College here in London with Neil Ferguson, Professor Neil Ferguson, who famously was behind the first lockdown and then proved that he didn't even believe in his own lockdown by nipping off for an affair with a fancy woman. But anyway, that's and then apparently getting sacked, although he was actually still on just as powerful a committee called NervTag, which was behind the second lockdown. So, of course, he wasn't actually sacked at all. So what do you make of this Bill Gates influence? There's lots and lots of money. This is he was at the time anyway the richest man in the world, funding these great blocks, great departments off the side of both Imperial College and John Hopkins University, Natalie.
Yeah, I mean, the Gates Foundation seems to have their funding all over the place. Bill Gates is like a trigger. You sort of, you know, he's like Marmite. You love him or you hate him. And he still does have his fans who, if you say a word against him, they immediately leap on you and start saying conspiracy theorist. But it's not conspiracy to say that this man's foundation is either the first or the second biggest funder of the World Health Organization. And that is a fact, and it's a glaring fact. The World Health Organization is dictating our lives. It's dictating most people on the planet's lives. And yet this man is basically the biggest funder of it, and his financial clout. I'm nothing against someone making a lot of money and doing well. It's not about being jealous or envious. But when these people are directing my life in a way that I don't think is healthy, then you have to do something about it. And apparently now it was just announced that he's the biggest holder of farmland in the United States. So he's buying up farmland and he's preparing to fire dust into the atmosphere. So how can this be allowed to happen? How can people sit back and just say that's okay, you know? Blocking out the sun, that's the plan.
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea, is to slow down global warming.
Well, that's what they're telling us it's about. Honestly, the guy must be bonkers.
James Perloff, I was speaking to author from the States, James Perloff, and he said, well, the thing with Bill Gates is he doesn't like anything that's natural.
Yes, I know. I mean, maybe global warming's happening. Whether man is to blame is another question. 11,000 years ago, Scotland was covered in an ice sheet. So, you know, over the years, that 11,000 years ago is a blink of an eye in world history. So climate does change. And I mean, it's a good thing. It's fine to say maybe we should stop pumping out carbon or try to keep our carbon low. But to start doing things like firing dust at the sun, what could possibly go wrong?
OK, well, let's look at the proposed solutions by some of these globalists to all of this. And that is I find it quite audacious that some of the same people that seem to be funding much of the problem, that is to say, the lockdown policies, the vaccines, these sorts of things. I mean, many would say those lockdowns unnecessary, counterproductive, etc. And the vaccines also, because of the various other treatments for COVID-19, such as ivermectin and chloroquine, which have been deliberately suppressed. So some of the same people actually involved in these kind of vaccine COVID business are also very much into this thing called the Great Reset. So there's a certain amount of audacity here that people that have been involved in creating a crisis have also got a solution for everybody at the same time called the Great Reset. What do you make of that?
It just, to me, it just seems potentially corrupt, but also, who elected these people? Why are they dictating our lives? Why, how did they get to where they are? There was a film of Klaus Schwab and talking to the leader of the EU, the EU Commission, the head of the EU Commission, I think it's Ursula von Leyen, and apparently she was elected by 385 people. These people have enormous power. So Klaus Schwab, I think very few people had even heard of him until last autumn. And he suddenly was all over the place. He took centre stage. So I was curious as to who he was. And I looked him up on Wikipedia and it said that he'd got a few degrees. He'd obviously done quite well academically. And then at the age of 33, he founded the European Management Forum, which eventually became the World Economic Forum. And it just presented it as, okay, he gets a few degrees and then he creates this economic forum that dominates the world, that's preparing to take over world leadership. How does that happen? And I just thought something is missing here. And I searched and searched, and it took me a while, but eventually I found this article published in Australia that said it was a sort of profile on him. It had been written a few years ago, and it said that he'd been a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee, but it didn't give any sourcing for it. So again, I did more and more research, and eventually I found this page from BilderbergMeetings.org, and that's apparently the official Bilderberg website. And it said that, yes, Klaus Schwab was on the Bilderberg Steering Committee. And strangely, that article had obviously been taken down because it was on archive.org. Someone had taken it and archived it. So I got the impression that this man's profile, someone had been kind of trying to tidy it up a little bit. And I looked further and eventually I found this really interesting academic paper published by the University of Freiburg by a man called Alexander Milos Zelensky. And it's called The Bilderberg Conferences as Transnational Informal Governance Network, which is quite a mouthful. But it's really interesting. And he basically was saying that he calls it a transnational power elite.
What I'm just wondering is if this Klaus Schwab and his amazing rise to fame and fortune through the World Economic Forum was sort of the wheels have been oiled, but through his connections to all the, well, I mean, I could say bankers, but you have to really say banksters. I mean, we're talking here about people who are running banks which have been convicted of all sorts of crimes, as well as, you know, people like the UBS Bank, HSBC, Deutsche Bank, etc., and have got these massive public bailouts, really, where they should have been just allowed to collapse. They're sitting around that same Bilderberg table, along with the war criminal Henry Kissinger.
Oh, yes, yes. absolutely. And all these people seem to have loads of these accolades. You know, they've got these honours and accolades, and no one really, well, I don't know why they get them, but it's, yeah, they have immense power. And yet, you're right, they've got these links with the banksters. I was listening to your show, the politics show, the last episode, and your interview with that David, who was completely ripped off by, well, it sounds as if he was ripped off by Lloyds Bank, and they were basically out to steal his house or something. It just sounds as if there's a lot of almost, I don't want to be libeling anyone, but it sounds as if there's a kind of undercurrent of gangsterism going on. So you've got this massive power elite, which is trying to lead the world. A very small elite, but it's got massive power. But they seem to be hand in hand with some very dodgy elements to me. And in fact, this academic paper that was published at the University of Freiburg is really interesting because it shows what a sort of narrow cultural kind of elite this is. Very strongly Anglo-Saxon in character. And until recently, he says it was very male-dominated. And he said that the USA is followed by the UK as by far the most dominant participant in the Bilderberg group, then by France, with the Netherlands in sixth place. But the Netherlands obviously is significantly influential in the inner circle because of the Dutch royal family and Prince Bernhard.
Well, also there's the European Secretariat is based in the university. I think it's at Leiden University in the Netherlands. So that's where they also started their very first ever meeting, the Bilderbergers, at a place called Oosterbeek, which is just outside Arnhem, where the Bilderberg Hotel is, where the first meeting took place. But yeah, I mean, maybe I think probably the first person to look at these elites very closely at them, published his book around about 1955. That is, well, the year after the very first ever Bilderberg meeting. Mm-hmm. And this is a book called The Power Elite. Right. By C. Wright Mills, the US sociologist, and it's a terrific read. It really is a rip-roaring book. He was actually quite a character himself. He used to ride from university talk to university talk over in the States on his motorbike, and he would explain this really as a completely separate policy-making body to elected governments, who they would co-opt people from elected governments. They would co-opt people from the Democratic press into their groups, but there was basically like a one-way street. So, you know, once you became part of the group, you were loyal to the group, not to the public, not to the voters, not to the readers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely, I mean, I'm surprised I hadn't heard of that book, and that was published in 1955. And then after that, you know, shortly after that, obviously there was the 60s, and everyone thought there was a lot of, life in Europe became much more egalitarian, much more diverse, and ever since.
Well, there was a very good high standard of living too in the 60s.
That's right. That's right. And it seemed as if the sort of ruling elites were sort of taking a back seat, and democracy was much more popular. People were having much more of a voice in parliament, ordinary people. But it's as if we are being pushed back now, and we're all being told that we. People always want to look for new leaders. But the new leaders who emerge always seem to be from a very narrow group. You look at people like Boris Johnson, and before him there was David Cameron and George Osborne, and they all went to the Bullingdon Club. And that's something that really interests me, because people often say that Boris Johnson looks as if he's like a puppet. And I feel that there's definitely something of that going on. These guys are compromised. They all come from that really close Eton Oxford elite, and when you look into the Bullingdon Club, it was hosted by Nat Rothschild, who's the son of Jacob Rothschild, who goes to the Bilderberg conferences, and he's very close to Henry Kissinger, and he was the son of Victor Rothschild. So I'm not one of these people who thinks that anyone with the name of Rothschild is sort of plotting to take over the world, because it's a huge, big family. But there's something about that particular family, that close-knit family, something going on there. There was also that incident with George Osborne on that yacht with Derry Pasca, and that was with Nat Rothschild as well. So it's as if these people are kind of power-broking to some extent, which would be fine, but then we've had two prime ministers who were in that close circle, and they have, you know, what's really going on here? How much, you know, how much of when people go to the polls, you know, I actually stopped voting a few years ago because I just felt the whole system's totally corrupt.
Well, that's one way of doing it. But, you know, that I suppose hands victory to those that want to, you know, disillusion voters and meet the voting doesn't matter, mind you.
Well,
because if you're voting for one Bilderberger or another Bilderberger, you might be right. You know, this whole thing about the Bullingdon Club, I think, is worth looking at a little bit closer, because if you go back to their days in Oxford, of course, these people all knew each other and they still know each other now, you know, with the editor of the Evening Standard, George Osborne, former Chancellor, being best mates with Boris, you know, and people like this through the Bullingdon Club. They're, you know, these are the guys who I suppose were just told when they were in their late teens at university, you know, you're going to be running the country one day, lads. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, what I found quite fascinating about that is they used to call George Osborne the Oik. And he was the sort of gopher for the more bullyish Bullingdon boys like Cameron and Boris. Mm-hmm. And he also had the job as the treasurer of the Bullingdon Club. Nice. So he had his little checkbook in his back pocket. And if there had been a wild party with loads of, you know, parts, bits of furniture being smashed, glasses being smashed and this sort of thing at the party, and lots of extra costs being ramped up to whoever was hosting them, the landlord or whoever, then it was George's job to turn up, you know, the next afternoon with a checkbook and saying, okay, how much was, you know, for all the damage we did last night.
So because he got a scholarship.
Grooming him to be a perfect Chancellor of the Exchequer, I suppose. Let's just look a little bit more at Scotland and the idea that Nicola Sturgeon has just come out with. That, I mean, although she's been talking about this for a while, she now seems very determined to have another Scottish independence referendum. I wonder what you make of that decision, and, you know, if you don't mind gazing into your crystal ball, where do you think the mood of the Scots is on this?
Oh, it's so difficult to judge, because last year there was actually going to be a clap for Nicola for her birthday, because people just were so admiring of what she was doing. I think that's broken down a bit. I know there's lots of people that cannot stand the women, but I think she's still quite popular. I don't know. I think that I've come to think, I did vote for the SNP in the early 2000s. I used to be a kind of left-wing Labour voter, and then I went off them. That was mainly because of Gulf War and other things. And then I started voting for SNP. I thought I really liked what they were doing. But I think for many people, the SNP is like a religion. And I once got a letter. It was when I was a journalist on a trade magazine. I got a letter from one of them, and it was signed "Yours in Scotland," the way that some fervent Christians would sign "Yours in Jesus." So I do think it's almost like a religion, and they know that if they get into power, it's their mission to try and get independence for Scotland. So I think that she's just carrying out her mission. I wouldn't really be. In theory, I'm still someone who I like the idea of independence for small countries. I don't like the Westminster system. I think the Scottish political system is a bit fairer since we've got devolution. But I think that I think what the SNP think is that if we got independence, it would be like a one-party state. They would be in power forever and ever. But that's not the case. They might. Labour was in power. Labour thought that they were going to be in power forever and ever, and look what happened to them. So I think people just need to just start, get away from party politics. That's what I think. But I don't know whether people will actually do that.
Have you been following the debacle between Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon?
Kind of. I must admit, I got a bit sick of it, but I didn't really. It seems so convoluted. I feel that Nicola has done enough to damage her. Well, yeah, she's done enough to damage her own reputation by fervently, not really, you know, just by laying down the law as diktats, really, the way that they're doing it all over the world. But so it's all, she doesn't really need to be, you know, it's Alex Salmond who was on trial. It shouldn't really be Nicola. I don't know. I don't really understand why people are focusing on that so much, in a way. I just tend to think that no one nice gets to be powerful in politics. If you're someone in politics that has genuine sincerity and genuinely wants to do good, then you're probably not going to get very far. So,
well, that certainly seems to be true nowadays. But anyway, I mean, as a former journalist yourself and someone that's still keeping your hand in by doing these podcasts, what do you make of the state of modern journalism? Is there anything you could point to that's positive much, or you know, what do you make of it?
From what I can see, most modern journalism is repeating press releases. There is some really good journalism about. It's similar to music. Maybe I'm just showing my age by saying that I just hate modern music, but I hate the music they play on the radio, but that doesn't mean that there isn't good music around. You've just got to look for it, and there's great journalism around, but it just doesn't get onto the mainstream media. The mainstream media has just become a mouthpiece of the elite, the establishment. This thing about free speech and censorship is absolutely outrageous. And it's been going on for years. It's reached a ridiculous state now. And again, it's something that when people talk about conspiracy theorists, I think they're actually burying their heads in the sand. They're not wanting to look at the outrageous corruption that's going on now, that Orwell warned about, that Aldous Huxley wrote about. I mean, I look at what talk radio were doing. They're actually daring to go against the grain, and their whole YouTube channel got taken down, but eventually it was put back up again. But the fact that that can happen, that people are literally being silenced because they're holding unfashionable opinions, is totally outrageous. I've come to really admire people like like Neil Oliver. He was completely hauled over the coals, not because he said anything bad or anything offensive, but because he said that he liked another historian, David Starkey. And then a couple of weeks later, David Starkey came out and said something really horrible and offensive, which he then apologised for. And Neil Oliver was completely slandered, completely bad-mouthed in the press, and he had to step down as the, I think he was the head of the National Trust, simply because he refused to take the tweet down where he praised David Starkey. And that's absolute madness, in my opinion.
Yeah, it seems to be quite a lot of demonisation of specific individuals. A lot of, basically, what I suppose this is character assassination going on. Yes. But anyway, are there any? I mean, it's always nice to give a plug to good sources of information, good sources of news in the days of really terrible journalism. I'd say appalling, you know, kind of stenography rather than real journalism, and questions simply not even getting asked, let alone answered, about some very important matters to do with public health, for example, at the moment. But are there any sites or papers or whatever that you would recommend other than that talk radio you just mentioned?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say that the politics show is really good, and I'm not just trying to flatter you, because you actually do investigative work. I really love the work of James Corbett, because, again, he does a lot of research. I just love anyone who puts in that hard work of doing research. I admire the people that go to the Bilderberg group, that get out there on the ground and source stories. there's a channel that I discovered recently, Hugo Talks. I really like that one. There's probably loads of others. I really like the work of Derek Bros as well. I think there are so many excellent journalists at the moment, but we've come to a state where if you do really good journal investigative journalism, then you're going to lose your income.
Yes, there's a sort of almost kind of suicidal thing going on there where the good journalists basically just get cut off and thrown over the cliff. Anyway, look, the big question, which we'll finish with, Natalie, is where you think this pandemic or plandemic, whatever you want to call it, is heading. Because most people, I think, now are pretty fed up with the idea of being on lockdown, as we have now been for a year, and being basically told that it's going to be an entire year of all these restrictions. And even now there's a vaccine on the horizon. It looks as if the vaccine isn't really going to be much of a solution either. So where do you think this is all heading?
Well, I don't want to be depressing, but as many people have said, it only ends when we say no. It's just going to go on and on and on, and it's going to get a much, much, much worse unless people really recognise their own power instead of looking for new leaders. Just get on with life and live life to the full. I think it only ends not just when we say no, but when we start getting on with our own lives and dealing with each other. So if you can't open your business because the government tells you not to, you've got to find other ways of doing business with other people. So we've got to connect with each other, because I don't think anyone's going to suddenly say the pandemic's over. What will happen is they're already bringing back global warming into the Davos forum. They'll start saying, well, because the temperature is going up, we're going to get more of these viruses. They're not getting killed off. So there'll be, as soon as coronavirus ends, there's going to be something else. It'll never stop until we actually say, I don't recognise these leaders. I'm going to follow my own intuition or my own power, connect with other people.
Yeah, creating almost like a hostile environment for human beings, yeah. A collective hysteria or something. I mean, it does all sound a little bit Orwell, a little bit Huxley, doesn't it?
Absolutely. We used to think they were fiction, but actually they were just writing about, it was like, it's happening now. So, yeah.
Anyway, how do people get hold of your podcast, Natalie, and follow your work?
It's on most channels, most of the big channels. I think it's on Apple Podcast, and it's also on my website, which is imaginingfreedom.co.uk. So if you go onto the website, the podcast is there. And it hasn't been updated for a while, but it's a good record of my feelings at the time of the pandemic. That's when it all started. So yeah, imaginingfreedom.co.uk. And I also do videos, and I usually produce them on Hive, which is hive.blog. Sorry, it's the ThreeSpeak platform, ThreeSpeak. That's the number three and then speak.co.
Okay, Natalie Minnis, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.